Chapter 52.
Buckland's papers were compelling, if not well received or widely circulated. According to JSTOR, Sam and Remy had been only the second party to purchase them since their publication. They had little trouble guessing the identity of the other interested party. Sam forwarded the papers to his iPhone and gave Remy the MacBook. Then they spent the next 3 hours wading through Buckland's work. Not wanting to taint one another's conclusions, they waited until they were finished to compare notes. "What do you think?" Sam asked. "Nutcase or genius?"
"Depends on whether he's right or wrong. There's no mistaking he's obsessed with Xerxes and Delphi. His version of the invasion didn't make him any friends in the academic world."
Through years of painstaking research, Buckland had come to an outlandish conclusion: that Xerxes' raid of Delphi had been more of a success than Greek historians admitted. According to Buckland, in the weeks leading up to the invasion, the keepers of the Sifnian treasury devised a scheme to protect their wealth. Knowing no place would be safe from Persian plunder, the Sifnians melted down their stores of gold and cast it into a pair of caryatides. When the columns cooled, they were covered in gypsum plaster and put in place of the real columns that stood astride the treasury's entrance. For reasons unknown, the Persian raiding party did not fall for the ruse. On Xerxes' orders, a detachment of 200 specially trained troops called Immortals fled with the Caryatides, intending to head north out of Greece before swinging east through Macedonia and Thrace and returning to the Achaemenid dynasty capital of Persepolis, where Xerxes planned to melt down the Caryatides and have them cast into a massive throne, a memorial to his triumph over the Greeks that would sit in his hall of 100 columns for eternity. Unbeknownst to the Immortals, word of their desecration of Delphi reached Sparta less than a day after the Persian raiding party left. A fratra of Spartan soldiers, roughly 27 in all, gave chase, intending not only to recover the Caryatides, but also to avenge the brothers they'd lost at the Battle of Thermopylae. They caught up to the Immortals in present-day Albania and cut off their easterly escape route. For 3 weeks the Spartans hounded the Immortals, chasing them north through Montenegro, then Bosnia and Croatia, before finally cornering them in the mountains of northwestern Slovenia. Even outnumbering them 10-1, the Immortals were no match for the Spartans. The Persian raiding party was all but destroyed. Of the original 200 that had left Greece a month before, only 30 survived, these spared to serve as porters for the Caryatides. The Spartan commander decided not to return home, not while Xerxes' army was still ravaging their country. The columns had become a symbol of Greece's survival, and the Spartans pledged to die rather than let them fall into Xerxes' hands. Not knowing how far the Persian invasion would advance, the Spartans headed north out of Slovenia, intending to find a place to hide the columns until it was safe to bring them home. The fratra was never seen again, save a lone soldier who stumbled into Sparta a year later. Before succumbing to his exhaustion and the ravages of exposure, he claimed that the rest of his comrades had perished and the Caryatides had been lost with them. Their location died with him.
"So that's the last puzzle piece," Remy said. "Or one of the last, that is. How Bondarrick and Buckland found each other, we may never know, but it's clear Bondarrick believes the story. He thinks Napoleon's lost cellar is a treasure map to the Sifnian columns. They're the family legacy he's trying to recover. Remember what else Kolkoff said in Marseille about Bondarrick's motive? He's simply trying to finish what was begun a long time ago." Sam nodded slowly. "The bastard wants to melt them down, just like Xerxes did. We can't let him get away with it, Remy. As archaeological artifacts, those Caryatides are priceless. Beyond priceless. It all fits. After the battles of Plataea and Mycale, Xerxes abruptly hands over control of the army to Mardonius and goes home. Goes home assuming the Caryatides are on their way. Most accounts have him returning to Persepolis and starting a massive building program, including the Hall of 100 Columns.
where Bucklin claims he planned to display the throne. I'll give you one guess where Bondarrak plans to put his throne. The Persian playground in the basement of his estate, Remy replied. It's sad, if you think about it. Xerxes died waiting for a prize that was never coming, a prize that meant relatively nothing to the Greeks, and Napoleon died waiting for his son to follow the riddles and recover the same prize. We might as well keep the streak alive, Sam said.
What do you mean?
We make sure Bondarrak dies never getting his hands on the Caryatides. He'll be in good company. At 6 the next morning, Sam's iPhone trilled. It was Selma.
It's early, Selma, he said groggily.
It's late here. Good news. We're getting better at this, I think. We've deciphered the code, but we thought you'd want first crack at the riddle.
Okay. Email it to me.
On its way. Call me later.
Sam shook Remy awake. She rolled over just as Sam's email chimed.
Another riddle, he said.
I heard.
He called up the email and together they read the lines. Man of history, 13 by tradition, house of Lazarus at Nazareth, son of Morpeth, keeper of Luce, the land that stands alone. Together they rest.
Any thoughts? Sam asked.
Ask me after coffee.
Having already unraveled two of the riddles, Sam and Remy now better understood the patterns Napoleon and Laurent had used to produce them. A patchwork of double meanings and obscure historical references, the solution to each puzzle depended upon the fusion of its individual lines. By mid-morning, they'd gathered from the internet the most obvious references for each line. The first, Man of History, 13 by tradition, likely referred to Histria, the Latin name for Istria, a peninsula between the Gulf of Trieste and the Bay of Kvarner in the Adriatic Sea. The second, House of Lazarus at Nazareth, could have hundreds of meanings. The name Lazarus was mentioned twice in the Bible, once as the man Jesus raised from the dead, the other in the parable of Lazarus the beggar. Nazareth, of course, was the childhood home of Christ. The third, son of Morpeth, keeper of Luce, was also too broad to nail down. Morpeth was a town in northeast England, and in Greek mythology, Luce was a nymph, the daughter of Oceanus. The fourth, together they rest, was the most ambiguous of all. Who were they? Did rest mean sleep or death, or something else altogether?
Think about the last riddle, Sam suggested. Napoleon and Laurent used a similar line, the genius of Ionia to reference Pythagoras. Maybe they're doing that here. We know the third line probably contains a place name, Morpeth. Let's find out if Morpeth was home to any famous residents.
Remy shrugged. Worth a try. An hour later, they had a list of a dozen semi-prominent Morpeth sons. None of them were immediately recognizable. Remy said, let's cross-reference, see if there's a connection between any of the Morpeth names and the word Luce. Are any of them experts in Greek mythology? Sam checked the list.
Doesn't look like it. What else do we know about Luce?
Remy paged through her legal pad. She was carried off by Hades, the god of the underworld. Depending on which version you go with, upon her death, she was transformed into a poplar tree, either by Hades or by Persephone.
Poplar tree, Sam murmured, tapping on the keyboard. The Luce is a type of poplar.
He checked his list of Morpeth names. This might be something. William Turner, born in Morpeth in 1508, considered by many to be the father of English botany.
Interesting.
So is the line about Turner himself, or about poplar trees?
No idea.
What's the last part? The land that stands alone?
My first thought would be island. They stand alone in the middle of water.
My thought, too. Sam's Google search of Island, Poplar, and Turner turned up no revelations. There are several references to a Poplar Island wildlife refuge in the Chesapeake Bay, but there's no connection to Turner. Unless you count Tina Turner donating some money to the refuge, that is. Let's try the first line again. Man of Histria, 13 by tradition. As they had with Morpeth, they generated a list of historical figures associated with the Istrian Peninsula, but like Morpeth, none of them were historically noteworthy. They turned to the second line, House of Lazarus at Nazareth, and dug deeper, looking for more obscure references. How about this? Remy said, reading from the MacBook screen. During the Middle Ages, Christian religious orders used to oversee leper colonies known as Lazar houses. As in Lazarus, the patron saint of lepers? Sam asked. Right. In Italy, the term Lazar morphed into Lazare, a quarantine station for ships and crews. The first recorded Lazare was established in 1403 off the coast of Venice, on the island of Santa Maria di Nazareth. She looked up at Sam. That could be our Lazarus and Nazareth connection. We're getting warmer, but it can't be that easy, he said. We're still missing the first line. He did another Google search, combining and subtracting words until he came across a 2007 National Geographic story describing the discovery of a mass grave for bubonic plague victims who had been quarantined to protect Venice's uninfected. Sam said the site was on an island in the Venice lagoon called Lazaretto Vecchio. Remy flipped through her notes. Vecchio. That's the modern name for Santa Maria di Nazareth. Sam, that's got to be it. Probably, but let's be sure. 20 minutes and dozens of search permutations later, he said, okay, here. I used the words island, Venice, and plague, and came up with this. Povelia. It's another island in the Venice Lagoon, used to quarantine plague victims during the 17th century. The bodies were buried in mass pits, sometimes the living mixed in with the dead or cremated in mass pyres. Estimates put the number of dead between... He paused, and his eyes went wide. What? Remy asked. Estimates put the number of dead between 160,000 and 250,000. Good Lord. Something else. Before it was called Povelia, it was Popelia. Why does that sound familiar? Popelia is a derivation of populus, Latin for poplar. Povelia was once covered in poplar groves. So on one hand we've got Povelia, on the other Santa Maria di Nazareth. Both are solid possibilities. You're right. It'll come down to the first line of the riddle and our mysterious man from Istria. Either way, our next stop is Venice. Sevastopol. I can tell by your tone the news is not good, Hadean Bondarek said into the phone. They're gone and one of my men is dead, Kolkov said. We found the transponder chip from the Fargo woman's phone aboard one of the electric boats. How they discovered it, I have no idea. Kolkov recounted the rest of the encounter at Koenigsee, starting with their arrival at St. Bartholomew and ending with his losing the Fargos on the lake. Somehow they must have slipped back into Schonau without us spotting them. Did they find the bottle? I don't know. And where are they now? We found a local that saw someone matching their description getting into a Mercedes. We traced it to a car service in Salzburg. We are on our way there now. We'll check the motels, the airport, the train stations. No, Bondarek said. Pardon me? Every time we get close to them, they slip the noose. I think it's time we step back and let the Fargos do what they do best. In the meantime, I want you to go ahead with your alternate plan.
There are risks.
I don't care. I'm tired of chasing these people all over Europe. You have a man in mind?
Yes, Kolkov said. According to my sources, he is the only one with a family. A wife and two daughters.
Get started. If he reports it rather than... Then make sure he doesn't report it. Convince him that cooperation is his only way out. You can do that much, can't you?
I'll make the call.